The Athletic. And he, I can't remember a Champions League knockout stage that was so dominated by one player. I mean, he was just almost single-handedly winning games.
Hello, welcome. Thanks for choosing to listen to us today. It's the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. I'm Ali Maxwell. On this week's episode, we are talking Ballon d'Or 2022. A look at the winners and contenders from the men's Ballon d'Or, the Coppa Award, which is for under 21 men's players, and the women's award as well. To do that with me, Michael Cox and Mark Carey are here to give thoughts and opinions. Hello, gents. All well?
Oh, well, Ali, how are you? I never ask you how you are.
No one ever asks the presenter. And that's why you're right up there as one of the best people I know, Mark. All very well, thank you. Lovely walk with the dog this morning, feeling fresh and ready to go. Michael,
there we go.
You've never asked me how I am.
No. All okay here. Pleased to hear you are well as well.
There is a strong argument that these questions don't need to be asked because no one listening ultimately cares that much.
Yeah, I have often thought that, yeah.
Hey, how about that Liverpool-Man City game on the weekend? Previewed in depth last week on this podcast, probably with a hint of concern for how the game might have gone for Liverpool. Far from it, a 1-0 win. Michael, in breaking down this game for The Athletic early this week or late on Sunday, what do you think were the key reasons for Liverpool winning the game?
Well, it was a funny one. I mean, the goal was just a complete anomaly, essentially a set piece or a counter-attack from a set piece. But I thought Liverpool were pretty good throughout the game. I was surprised that Guardiola went with the system he did, kind of a three at the back, boxing midfield. I thought that left a lot of space for Liverpool out wide. And I thought Liverpool actually could have exploited that a bit better. It was Harvey Elliott who was getting the most space out on the right. And much as I like Elliott, I mean, I think he's a brilliant player for his age. I did think Liverpool could have done with a real kind of proper speedy attacker down that side. And for me, that was the theme of the game. You know, that was what my article was about. Back in the day, you'd have Mane and Salah on the flanks for Liverpool and maybe Sterling and Sané on the flanks for City. Whereas in this game, you had Jota, not really a winger. Elliot, not really a winger. João Cancelo, definitely not a winger. And probably Foden was the closest thing to a proper wide attacker. So to me, it just had a very different feel to a lot of the games between these two sides in the past. But yes, it was a very good game and a bit of a surprise result, if we're being honest. I mean, you're right, Ali. We were talking about... I mean, I said if there's a lot of goals in this game, I fear for Liverpool. One good thing for them was that there wasn't many goals. And I think they were probably the better side in the game.
I think Liverpool just knew how dangerous Manchester City were. I thought, you know, Michael's piece on site outlined it brilliantly, but I think Liverpool are far less open to the counter-attacks that have basically plagued them this season, not just the goals, which have been so obvious, but the chances that they've given up that haven't led to goals. And they were themselves really counter-attacking, I thought. And of course, I looked at the numbers and Liverpool had 11 direct attacks, which I think we've spoken about before. They're possessions that start in a team's defensive half and result in a shot or a touch inside the box within 15 seconds. So a proxy of counter-attacking play. And 11 direct attacks is the highest that Liverpool have had in the last 2.5 seasons. So it was really clear what Liverpool were looking to do. Maybe not as much go toe-to-toe with Manchester City like we've maybe seen in recent seasons, but stay compact, press when there was a sort of a moment, a trigger to press, and make the most of counter-attacking play. And eventually, the goal that came was essentially from that, albeit quite a direct one.
Hugely impressive display and hugely impressive result. It'd be interesting to see Liverpool cracking on from here until the break for the World Cup, at least. It'd be fantastic to see them start to put together several dominant performances and move back towards the top of the table and contribute to what might be quite an interesting title race. At this moment in time, that's how it feels anyway. Michael, you were at the Spurs-Everton game over the weekend as well. Anything of tactical interest there?
Well, it was a good match for you, Ali, because Dwight McNeil was dropping back into something of a left wing-back role, which I haven't seen him do before, but I have seen suggested by you on this podcast. So I think you were the main winner from that fixture. Mm-hmm.
So it was a sort of hybrid role, was it? I guess I can't claim, you know, full victory here yet until he's, you know, what sort of positions was he taking up in possession? I gather he was dropping in to play the left of a five out of possession. So it's a good start. What about in possession? Because this was about crossing from deep and actually not being the one, you know, getting to the byline necessarily.
Yeah, I'd say he was more of a forward in possession, at least in theory. But they dropped him back to cope with, who was on that side? Doherty on that side. So they were kind of matching Spurs front five with the back five. And it meant Mykolenko dropped into a left-sided centre-back role. I mean, the thing is, Everton spent so long without the ball, it wasn't really that relevant what they did when, or what he did when they had the ball. So, yeah, I mean, if you look at the average positions, I suspect he was very much a wing-back.
Let's talk Ballon d'Or. The results on Monday night, the big gala, and the winner, the men's award winner, Karim Benzema. Michael, he was fourth on the podium. Can you be fourth on a podium, or is that limited to three spots? I'll get back to you on that. He came fourth in the voting last season, but he wins it this time around. The first French winner of the award since Zizou, 1998. The oldest winner of a Ballon d'Or since Stanley Matthews in 1956. Your reaction to Benzema being crowned Ballon d'Or winner for the first time in his career? Happy with that? Would you have had anyone else?
No, I think he deserves it. I think it's really impressive. I must admit, I've kind of always underestimated him. I always had him down as a decent player, kind of 8 out of 10 in every area player. But he's obviously just gone to a completely different level over the last few years, particularly since Ronaldo's departure. And I couldn't really see any other alternative here. I mean, there was no Euros or World Cup this year. There was an AFCON, so that comes into play. But really, I think it was about the Champions League knockout stages. And I can't remember a Champions League knockout stage that was so dominated by one player. I mean, he was just almost single-handedly winning games. So yeah, it's an incredible achievement. And one thing, I don't know whether anyone else has pointed this out, but for quite a while, towards the start of his career, I suppose, he was always in competition with Gonzalo Higuain for who should start up front for Real Madrid. And it was always a bit 50-50, I must admit. I always slightly favoured Higuain. I thought he was just a better finisher, better number nine. And they're very similar age. In fact, they were born 9 days either side of one another.
Wow.
Those 9 days in between, in fact, I was born. So a real, real topical December 1987 for this. But Higuain announced his retirement this week, you know, having been in MLS for 3 years. And what a contrast that is. One's announcing a retirement, and in the same week, the other one wins the Ballon d'Or for the first time. I mean, that shows how late Benzema's peaked. And yeah, I think a really, really impressive achievement to win this.
I think it's fair to say that you're still not reaching your peak, Michael. You've still got so far to go as well.
I think I peaked too early, to be honest. I'm more on the Higuain scale than the Benzema scale, I think.
A lot of people have been wondering whether you've got an idea for a third book, and at the moment the evidence is pointing to perhaps the fact that you don't. So, you know, more to be seen on that point. Mark, a breakdown of Benzema's year, the numbers that back it all up. What an incredible season.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And this is the thing. I don't think you can, you know, I agree with Michael. I don't think you can really complain about him winning. And it wasn't just the goals in La Liga, as Michael said, 27 goals in La Liga, obviously winning La Liga as well. But it was the volume and the importance of the goals in the Champions League. So 15 goals in the Champions League, which is just ludicrous in itself. But he sometimes won the games on his own out of what were half chances. Some of them is just flashing across him. And I just remember he was just putting it in the corners with just such skill. And, you know, you break it down. So Paris Saint-Germain, he scored a hat-trick. Next game against Chelsea, scored a hat-trick from the round of 16 and the quarterfinals. The other game against Chelsea, scored a goal. Two goals against Manchester City in the away leg in the semi-finals. Another goal in the home leg. Granted, didn't score in the final, but obviously, you know, Real Madrid won the Champions League. And it's just him stepping up in those sort of important games as well as the volume. 12 assists in La Liga as well, which isn't to be sniffed at. So it just kind of felt like his season. So absolutely no complaints about him winning.
It strikes me as Mark talks, particularly about that game against Chelsea, that Benzema was often, as many players in his position are, compared to original Ronaldo, Brazilian Ronaldo, in the early parts of his career, because he was so dynamic and he could throw a step over, cut inside and smash it into the net from 20 yards. He could run in behind, and you know the physical attributes and the technical skill were a pretty heady mixture in those early years at Lyon. Of course, the development of him as a player has taken him to a very different profile of striker, which we'll talk about in a second. But that game against Chelsea, that performance against Chelsea, was almost his and I guess the appreciation of the English football fans who witnessed it, in this case Chelsea, was somewhat reminiscent, Michael, of Ronaldo's game against Manchester United back in 2003, which is always referred to as one of the best performances from an opposing player on English soil in the Champions League game.
Yeah, it was really fantastic. I remember watching this game. I was in an Irish pub in Chicago with about three other people, just like looking around at each other, thinking, "Wow, this is absolutely amazing." It was, yeah, and he did it in multiple games in the Champions League knockout stage. I mean, kind of to repeat what I said before, I can't remember last time a knockout stage was so dominated by one player. I think probably Kaká in 2007, which was the with the exception of that Modric in 2018, before the Messi and Ronaldo era, he was the last one to win it. That felt like a similar kind of thing. So, yeah, he's fantastic. I mean, I was looking at the odds for the Ballon d'Or a couple of weeks beforehand. And I mean, he was about 10-1 on Benzema. There was no other candidates, really. And I think that's probably fair.
There's a lot of talk about peak age in football. Mark, it's a part of data analysis and in some cases splitting that, you know, it's different per position. There's been a lot of work done on this. How then do we explain Karim Benzema being the best player in the world 14 years after his first 20-goal league season with Lyon?
Yeah, he's kind of breaking the mold, but there's been plenty of players who have broken the mold, obviously Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo being key to that. And I think it is something where, yeah, you're right, analysis has been done on peak age. Tom Warville, who's someone we still shout out to this day, which I'm very glad of, has done analysis on that and breaking it down per position of peak age. And I do think it's something which needs to be constantly evolved, because what is the peak age 10 years ago, 20 years ago, etc., is probably no longer necessarily peak age. And it just seems like there's almost too many players. The sample size that's big enough to question, is 34 probably what we'd consider to be, now it doesn't sound that ridiculous, but maybe a 31 of a few seasons ago, that there's just enough, granted, elite players who are just tipping it slightly towards, yeah, getting to mid-30s and still being at the peak of their powers. But then you give the example of Higuain as well, that's a sample of two, and one's, you know, just retired and one's, yeah, arguably at the peak of their powers. So,
but there's plenty of, you know, maybe not winning Ballon d'Ors, but if, can you say Ballon d'Ors? That feels wrong. As someone with a French degree, I feel like I've probably upset some French people there. Let's move past it. There are also, Mark, and it's the beauty of the game, plenty of players between the ages of, 17 and 23 who are heavily impacting elite football as well. So it's a broad church at the moment, isn't it? Mm. Michael, I wonder if a part of the conversation about Benzema's age links in with the conversation about how he is playing in the last few seasons, how he is impacting games, winning games at the very top level, predicated not on a physicality that sets him apart or being absolutely genius on the ball like Messi at his peak, let's say, but it feels to me like a sort of triumph of football intelligence, of the sort of movement and timing of runs that often comes with experience.
Yeah, I agree. I think experience is a big factor. I would very broadly say that players who rely on athleticism and dynamism tend to pick young, and players who are in more central positions, whether that's centre back, central midfield, or this type of centre forward, tend to pick later. Obviously, there's big variations within that, but you're right. I think it's not just the post-Ronaldo thing. I think he is a better player now than he was 5 years ago. And the interesting thing, of course, is that he missed out on France winning the World Cup. I mean, that's the one thing lacking, really, from his career. He's won the Ballon d'Or. He's won the Champions League multiple times. And next month, or the month after, if we're being strict, he's got the chance to put that right. And if he does win the World Cup as the reigning Ballon d'Or holder, he probably goes up to another level in terms of how he's regarded as one of the all-time best players.
Well, in previous years, a World Cup in November, December would have been a real sort of headache for the Ballon d'Or, wouldn't it? But they changed it. This was the first time in the history of the award that it was given based on the results of a season, as we would define it in European football anyway, or in major European football, between August and July, instead of just the calendar year, which, to my eyes anyway, clearly simplifies things. So pat on the back there for whoever made that change, made that decision. Just a word on the award in general, Michael, are you happy with the Ballon d'Or as an award, as a proxy for best player in the world for a certain year, or as is now the case, a certain season? Does it generally do a good job of reflecting that, in your opinion?
I think overall, yes. I think broadly speaking, it does. I must say, I think it's been a really bad few years for the concept and the institution of the Ballon d'Or, which used to be just a hugely respected award. But I think they've made some real cock-ups, to be honest. There was the slightly weird merge with the FIFA award, which lasted for a few years, and then they split again. I found that quite confusing. I thought the decision to cancel the award in 2020 was very strange, considering the vast majority of countries still played a full league season. Then they, I think I'm right saying, didn't they, because they felt bad that Lewandowski didn't win it, they kind of just invented an award to give to him the next year that was like best striker award. And then that vanished for the year afterwards, which kind of just showed they were trying to make up for it. And there's a slightly weird thing now with the voting change. They're switching to a system where only the top 100 FIFA-ranked nations have a vote. And I don't really like that. I think that's quite patronising, really. And I think there was something really nice about the fact that, you know, a judge from, I don't know, Burkina Faso had as much as a, you know, as much of a say as a judge from Brazil or something. I think that's, I mean, you'll get some fairly established countries just outside the top 100. I think it's the top 50 for the women's game as well.
I always thought the delegate from Vanuatu was absolutely spot on with his voting. So.
Well, you're probably right. I mean, there's nothing to say that, I mean, you know, you can look at who the person voting for England is, and not sure I'd necessarily take their view over the one from Vanuatu. So, yeah, there's a few things that I think they've made a few errors. The thing is, there's so many individual awards now, just in so many different categories. And the Ballon d'Or has got that history and that prestige. And I can't help thinking they've slightly ruined that with some of their decisions over the last few years, even if I think you're probably right about the calendar year thing. I think it probably does make sense.
This could sound hugely ignorant, but I just want to double check. Who does make the decision for England? Who's the English delegate for this?
I'm not sure off the top of my head.
I thought there was someone.
I have a suspicion.
I like that you don't even know who it is, but you.
Whoever.
But you. In, but you.
I,
you
just, I know who. I know inher- it was. Yeah, no, it was 10 years ago.
You inherently don't think that they're a very good judge, even though you don't have a particular person in mind.
No. Anyway, just. Yeah.
Was there a bit of noise when Hodgson did it?
I mean, that was quite. He voted for Mascherano number one, didn't he?
Oh, of course.
Which I thought that was a really good shout. I mean, I would have voted for Messi because Messi was the best player in the world. But Mascherano had a brilliant World Cup. Like, he was so good in that tournament. And if you're an international manager who has a team at the World Cup, albeit not for too long, I thought that was a fair point. To be honest, I thought it was a fair shout.
Mascherano walked so that Messi could run, a lot of people thought at that time. In second place in 2022 edition of Ballon d'Or was Sadio Mane. We're just going to whiz through those who came second to fifth, sixth, seventh. I was interested in this. What's the case for Sadio Mane in second here, specifically in relation to his club teammate Mo Salah, who came fifth? Of course, at club level, they have to have achieved the same. So is it as simple as AFCON winner versus AFCON runner-up? Or, Mark, based on performances last season, is it fair to have Mane over Salah as well as that?
Yeah, I'd say the international achievement did probably edge it here. And I think that with these sorts of awards, they do tend to favour those who have been more successful for either their club, but as you say, in this case, not relevant, but for their country. And is it fair to say that Messi, I mean, we know how great Messi has been over years, but last year the Copa America was maybe kind of included as a weight within the decision. I don't know. But in terms of Mane's numbers, 16 league goals, only 2 assists, surprisingly. I thought that he was kind of more creative than that. 0.5 non-penalty goals per 90, which was
Mark,
completely
hold on.
In line.
You're not measuring creativity with assists, are you?
His expected assists weren't too high either, I must add. But but to only have 2, like, it wasn't even worth kind of really considering, you know, the a higher volume of, of numbers in terms of expected assists, because I thought that considering where he kind of used to be on creativity, he seems a lot lower last year. And I know that he had the sort of renaissance of playing more centrally, and maybe there's an element of recency there where he sort of ended the season really well, having not done too well at the start of the season. And the season before that, he, I think he was just something really wasn't clicking, not just for Liverpool, but for him as well. But 5 goals in the Champions League for Mane, and you compare it with Salah. Okay, so 23 goals for Salah, but only 18 non-penalty goals. So not too dissimilar from Mane's 16 league goals. And Salah with 13 assists and his expected assists, you'll be pleased to know Ali was quite in line there as well. A higher non-penalty goal rate, 8 goals in the Champions League as well for Salah. So if you were to look at it based on the numbers, you'd maybe, of an individual output, you'd maybe give the edge to Salah. But I do think, coming back to what you asked, that the international achievement probably was a bit of a swinging factor there.
Michael, let me just lob the Belgian Kevin De Bruyne into the mix here as well. He was in the top five. I think he was third, wasn't he, with Lewandowski fourth and Salah fifth. Just way up for me, KDB up against Mane and Salah, finishing beneath Mane but above Salah. Of course, De Bruyne won the Premier League's official Player of the Season award. Salah won the PFA Player of the Season award. So there's quite a lot to chew on here.
Yeah, I mean, obviously he's in there for really good, consistent Premier League performance, which I think is fair enough. I think he was excellent. He showed another side to his game last year. He scored that hat-trick against Wolves. Hasn't really been a prolific goal scorer. Much more of an assister, and I think he's shifted back this season to be more of an assister. But yeah, I think he deserves to be up there. I think on Mane, it is about the international stage, and I think that is right. I mean, the AFCON was the tournament of this year, and twice he got the better of Salah in Senegal against Egypt games, one in the AFCON final and one in the playoff for the World Cup. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably what tipped it. Okay, they're both on penalties, and you can say if the shootout goes the other way, maybe does the voting go the other way? Maybe, but you can say that for, I don't know, Cannavaro in 2006. If Italy don't win the World Cup on penalties, Cannavaro probably doesn't win the Ballon d'Or. So I'm pleased to see them both up there. Having looked at the voting, I don't think the figures have been released in terms of who voted for whom yet, but I suspect Mane and Salah probably got a huge share of votes from African countries because that was their big tournament this year, and I think that's absolutely right.
The Kevin De Bruyne shout as well, I think we spoke about this with the FIFA Pro Awards. I do think they just consider what we consider to be the basic numbers of, you know, just goals and assists. And because Kevin De Bruyne scored 15 league goals, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 8 assists, which from a goal scoring perspective was the best season of his career. You think about how good of a finisher he is. He's a fantastic finisher, but that was from an expected goals of 6.4 in the Premier League. So he heavily overshot his expected goals. I don't know, you just maybe think that he's a fantastic player, the performances that he gives and the importance that he adds to Manchester City, but is he kind of bumped up simply because from a numbers perspective, he was as good as he ever had been last season as well? I don't know.
Well, Robert Lewandowski was about as good as he ever has been, and that is very, very good consistently. I like to pull out the stat that in 16 full seasons, Robert Lewandowski has been the top scorer in the league, in which he plays 10 times, comes second 3 times, he's come third 2 times. The only season where he wasn't in the top three was his first season at Dortmund, where he was just settling into life in the Bundesliga. He's top of the La Liga charts at the moment. At last season's goal tally, Mark, as strong as ever and worthy of a top five finish, he finished in fourth.
Yeah, and 35 goals in the Bundesliga last season was higher than any other player in the top five European leagues. And even if you take out penalties, he was still basically averaging a goal per game, which was just mad. But I just find it funny, kind of alluding to what you just said, that wasn't even the highest tally of his career. So he scored 41 goals in the previous season. So that level of consistency is just frightening, to be honest. Slight quiz question for you both. Interestingly, on a per 90-minute basis, there was only one player who had a higher goal-scoring rate than Lewandowski last season. Also in the Bundesliga, not named Erling Haaland. Can you get it? He's exactly one goal per 90, but obviously fewer minutes played.
I'm going to guess Christopher Nkunku.
Good shout, but it was actually Patrick Schick at Leverkusen. You had a fantastic season at Leverkusen. Maybe wasn't quite given the recognition outside of Germany that maybe he should have done. But sorry, yeah, I'm not normally the one who asks the questions. But a frightening season for Lewandowski, scoring for fun, and has clearly carried that on at Barcelona.
Just stay in your lane, Mark, okay? You're going to start... Or at the very least, let me know what you're going to ask before we record so that I can have the answer ready. Michael, Kylian Mbappe finished sixth. You wrote about him this week, and I thought it was a really interesting piece. It touched on last season, so let's start there. In the 21-22 season, and try and ignoring all of the current transfer noise, off-field stuff, he had an unbelievable campaign, and in some ways that people maybe wouldn't have, maybe wouldn't expect.
Yeah, he came second in the goal-scoring charts across Europe behind Lewandowski, and he also came second on the assist charts behind Thomas Müller. And, okay, Ligue 1 is easier to get goals and assists in, especially if you're playing for PSG. But that's not really the point. I think the point is that he was suddenly such a prolific assister. He doubled his previous best assist tally. And this is the player he wants to be. I mean, there's been a lot of moaning from him over the last week or so, and I think a lot of that has been... probably rightly seen as quite unprofessional and quite tedious and just typical PSG. But I think when you look at what he's actually saying and what he's actually complaining about, I think it's really interesting. He's saying he doesn't want to be just a number nine. He wants to be someone who is involved in more of the game. He wants to come short and create. He wants to be an all-round attacker. And I do think that's quite interesting that he's... I mean, most people would say, yeah, I'd quite like to play up front with Messi and Neymar providing through balls to me. That will go down quite nicely. But yeah, modern forwards want to be different. It tends to be the way. Even someone like Lewandowski, you know, seemed to consider himself as much a number 10 as a number 9. No one really wants to be a pure striker.
I wonder what feels that the most obvious fit right now for him, if, let's say, he'd love to play on the left of a front three, but dropping in and getting involved in build-up as well as running in behind. Barcelona spring to mind in that they have Lewandowski as the nine. They've got some incredible ball-playing midfielders, and obviously Mbappe would improve them quite a lot off the left. I don't say Real because they have Vinicius, who's been magnificent in what strikes me as a similar role to what Mbappe would be after. I'm avoiding saying Manchester City because the thought of Mbappe and Haaland playing together is a bit too much to compute. It's certainly an interesting question.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Thibaut Courtois won the Lev Yashin Trophy. And I think it'd be interesting just to touch on goalkeepers because... in three editions, or the last three editions of this award, there have been three different winners and seven different goalkeepers out of the nine spots on the podium, which seems like a decent range over 3 years. And Mark, seems to me to tie into discussions that we've had before just about the difficulty in definitively rating goalkeeper performance and how goalkeeper performance changes over seasons.
Yeah, that's a really good point about the volatility of a sort of shot-stopping performance. It's like thinking about a striker's performance as well. But yeah, I think talking about goalkeepers was my debut on this podcast, and we have spoken a lot about it since, and thinking, you know, about things like expected goals on target and goals prevented, you know, based on the quality of shot and things like that. But you think about, yeah, the best keepers playing for the best teams, so they don't have quite as much to do. So some keepers are busy than others. So maybe some keepers' numbers can be quite skewed by the fact that they are busier, so they have more opportunity to save shots and prevent goals. So what you can do as a way sort of around that is to look at goals prevented rate, which adjusts for the volume of the shots, and see, I guess, the degree to which a goalkeeper concedes at a rate above or below. So above or below one. So a figure above one means they're saving more than they're conceding, and below one is vice versa. So that's probably a good way to, I guess, have a bit of a workaround, because as you say, some goalkeepers are busier than others, but there's so many unquantifiables with goalkeepers as well. And there's, I guess, so many blind spots when using metrics to appraise and numbers to appraise a goalkeeper's performance. So I think the best analyst around in looking at the numbers within this is John Harrison, does fantastic goalkeeper analysis and some great work looking at things like body position in one-on-ones and created his own models around that and looking at optimal strategies of those one-on-ones depending on the context and things like that. But that's also just then looking at, I guess, what is half of the job of a goalkeeper. So you haven't even factored in distribution and having the ball at your feet, which is so integral to what a goalkeeper does now. So really hard to rate with numbers, far more qualitative, I think, with goalkeepers. But there's no doubt Courtois has had a great season, and he's said so as much, hasn't he?
He has. But I'm not even on the podium, being the goalkeeper who's won La Liga and the Champions League. Not a happy man. Michael, do you think he has a point? Are goalkeepers underrated in these kind of awards, in these kind of polls?
I've got to say, I find Courtois really irritating as a player, but annoyingly, I think he has got a point here. I mean, he was man of the match in the Champions League final, one of the best individual performances you'll see in a Champions League final. He was really good throughout the season. I'm not sure he necessarily deserves to win it, but probably the best shout a goalkeeper's had, I guess, is Neuer in 2014, who I think was really notable because of how he played, you know, tactically how he played the role of goalkeeper. Courtois, I'd say a much more traditional goalkeeper, a shot stopper, really. But he did have a very good season and probably does deserve to be a little bit higher on the list, yeah.
Hey, there's an award called Club of the Year. It feels like a complete waste of time. It feels like the Champions League trophy is a good, pretty good proxy for that. But it didn't go to the winners of the Champions League trophy, Real Madrid. Instead, it went to Manchester City after Pep's side won their fourth Premier League title in five seasons. Michael, what's this all about? I sort of, like, inherently, Real Madrid fans getting really angry about something like this, I would probably try and be a bit more measured, but I think I'm fully with them here. What's going on here?
Yeah, I don't know really what the point in this award is. I completely agree with you. I think if you're going to have an award like this, it'd be really nice to go for kind of a bit of an outsider, like someone who's punched above their weight, and you know,
Union Berlin.
Ah, nice.
I mean, yeah, maybe a bit early for them, but I mean, Senegal would be, I mean, that would be a nice one to give. I mean, they won their first ever AFCON. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be nice to give recognition to someone outside the elite, since, you know, like you say, there is literally a trophy for the best team, the best club team. Waste of time.
I only realised this morning, having read Sam Lee's piece, but I didn't realise that the Club of the Year is based on who the club is who has the most individual nominations across the different categories.
Oh.
So it's adding it all up together, I think.
That would have been such valuable research to do before the podcast. So well done, Mark.
It's okay. We're there. We're there now. It's fine. So I think that's kind of why. But I suppose that I'm making the case for Manchester City a little bit more here based on that. So I think that's how it came to be.
Okay. And a quick gut instinct winner.
Hang on. I've got the voting figures here. Real Madrid have got four of the top nine. Man City have got third, 12th, 22nd, 22nd, 25th.
I think it says across all categories.
Okay.
Think, yeah.
Sorry. Maybe you're right. Oh, hang on. Then Haaland. Well, does Haaland count? Because this is just last season, isn't it?
Well, that's a good question.
Probably doesn't count. Ugh, it's very complex, this.
It's turning into an expose, I would say. Also, you say across all awards. I mean, Courtois, we know, won the Yashin Award.
I know.
We're about to talk about the Copper Award, where Real Madrid had the player in second, Man City nowhere to be seen in that. Very strange. Next year's predictions, we are but 2 months into the season. Michael and Mark, give me a gut instinct winner for the Ballon d'Or 2023.
So much depends on the outcome of the trophies. I mean, the way that Haaland started the season, if he carries on that and City either win the league or the Champions League, I think he's going to be there or thereabouts, surely. I'm surprised he wasn't higher for this award, to be honest. Haaland's got to be up there. I want to see Bellingham up there as well, as someone who's just so exciting to watch. They're my initial shouts.
Michael, what about Lionel Messi wasn't even on the shortlist last season. Pretty decent numbers so far this campaign.
Yeah, I did think it was slightly odd he wasn't even in the on the shortlist. I mean, he took a while to get going at PSG, but I still think I'd have him ahead of some of the players who did make the shortlist. For next year, I mean, I think the World Cup will play a big part. I think Benzema could be up there again. I don't think it's impossible that Neymar is up there again. Yeah. I think Brazil, well, they'd be my favourites for the World Cup. Neymar will be their star player. I think he could come into contention. But yeah, you have to think the World Cup will probably play a big role. Although, I don't know, maybe people will have forgotten by next October if it's 10 months on. It's very difficult to say.
Mm. Well, recency bias, I guess that's another question. How much does that affect awards like this? I think now that it is purely seasonal and wrapped up in each season, I think that will help guard against recency bias, which certainly seemed like a bit of an issue in its previous guise. Let's just weigh up the Copa Trophy. This is for under 21 men's players. Gavi of Barcelona won it. Camavinga of Real Madrid second. Musiala of Bayern Munich third. And Jude Bellingham of Dortmund fourth. Are we okay with Gavi winning the Copa Trophy? What is it about him and his performances last season that makes him number one?
Well, he's a very, very good player. He's typically Barcelona, isn't he? I think he's just one of those players who, as soon as you see him, it's obvious that he's very, very talented. I think it probably could have gone to any of the top four, really. Camavinga, Musiala, Bellingham. I always am a little bit sceptical about this award because I'm not sure how many people really know enough or see enough to compare, I don't know, Bellingham to Nuno Mendes. I mean, you've got to have such a good knowledge and have seen such a lot of all the players across leagues. So I think it's a bit of a funny one. But I must say the quality of the top four is very good. I mean, probably as strong as it's been for a few years, I would say. Gavi, Camavinga, Musiala, Bellingham. I mean, they are really, really good players. I haven't done so, but I reckon if you go back 4 years, it's probably not as strong as this.
I think you're probably right. I the difference between second, third and fourth is arguably fairly unimportant. But Camavinga being second, having only started 13 league games and one Champions League game for Real Madrid last season, it is interesting to me. I wonder if he just gets a sort of multiplier because his club won the Champions League.
But to be fair, he did. When he came on in the Champions League, he did, like, I mean, they had a lot of comebacks, didn't they, in that Champions League period. And I think he did genuinely spark a couple of them.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. It's interesting to me, Mark, that with Casemiro having departed, Camavinga having been sort of waiting in the wings somewhat, I perhaps naively thought he might be earmarked for those minutes. But so far this season, only four La Liga starts. It's Tchouaméni who's playing in that position and started in El Clasico on the weekend. Is Camavinga going to have to wait for a Modric and a Kroos to leave before he starts starting games?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when he was at Rennes, he was playing, well, he could play in a central midfield or a defensive midfield role. And I think it was more in a double pivot than on his own. I think that Tchouaméni's attributes and qualities probably would be a bit more of a like-for-like replacement with Casemiro as being a bit more of a player to break up the play, be a bit more of a defensive destroyer. And I think that Camavinga's versatility may almost work against him here, where he could sort of play anywhere, whereas Tchouaméni's really good in a central defensive midfield role. So I think given that Modric is, we've been saying this for two or three seasons though, aging and probably a season away or a couple of seasons away from maybe retiring, then Camavinga will be the heir to the throne there. But Modric just keeps going on and is just such, he still has such high quality. So I think more the sort of replacing Casemiro with Tchouaméni makes more sense, and Camavinga is able to play a bit more on the left or right of a three rather than just in the central defensive midfield role.
And Musiala had an excellent campaign last season. His numbers this campaign are obscene. Mark, just explain Musiala to me as if I've never seen him play before. What makes him so good? What's his role and what's behind his numbers this season?
Yeah, he's kind of, as a teenager already, a bit like Bellingham actually, he's made himself kind of indispensable to such a high quality team. Obviously Bayern Munich, they've lost, because they lost Lewandowski, they've sort of shared the attacking contribution around a little bit more evenly between Musiala, Sadio Mane, Leroy Sané and Thomas Müller, with, I guess, Serge Gnabry and Kingsley Coman off the bench as well and rotating between starting lineups. But he is so versatile and flexible, Musiala. He can play anywhere across Bayern's midfield in wide areas. He's played briefly as a striker for a short period, I think, since the start of last season. And he's added attacking output to his game. His goal scoring is running a little bit hot this season. He scored 5 goals from an XG of 2.7. I think he's got 4 assists as well. So his overall goal contribution is higher than anyone else in the Bayern squad, certainly within the league. But I think his main skill set is that he's really mature for his age. He can keep possession so well. He's got real close control, quite a wiry frame, so he's able to twist and turn at really sort of sharp pace and just get away from opponents with ease as well. You sort of step off him, you can pick a pass, you get tight to him, he can wriggle away from you, all still as a teenager as well. So massively exciting, but almost as a compliment to him, you couldn't really pin him down to a certain position because he's so versatile.
And that makes me consider him just such an intensely modern young star, that the sorts of players that are being produced at the moment, it feels like this mixture of on and off ball attributes, a kind of universality, I think they call it, where feels like you could fill in 6 different roles and still perform at the same level and still have a similar output because of the intelligence more than anything and the technical skill. Michael, can I be a biased England fan and say that Jude Bellingham was a bit hard done by here, not being in the top 3. He played a lot more than Camavinga and Musiala. 30 starts in the league, 8 in the Champions League. Just 12 starts in the league for Musiala last season and 5 in the Champions League. Both of those players have 17 international caps already, which just seems incredible for their age. It's such an exciting future for both of them. But Bellingham, a bit hard done by?
A little bit, but didn't figure in the latter stages of the Champions League. And I think that's where this award is kind of won.
And who do you think of the... let's say the 5, we'll bring Nuno Mendes in, who finished 5th, of Gavi, Camavinga, Musiala, Bellingham, Nuno Mendes, the top 5 in this year's Coppa Trophy. Who do you think has the highest ceiling?
I don't know. I'm never very good at judging a player's ceiling. As I've said earlier, I didn't think Benzema would be this good. The one I like the most is Camavinga. I just think he's brilliant on the ball. He's a different type of player to the others. Probably the deepest operating of the... the 4, I'm excluding Nuno Mendes here, sorry. But yeah, I think he's fantastic. And it's opened, I mean, Real Madrid didn't intend to sell Casemiro, but it's opened up for him, I think, to really make a place in the team his own.
I think Bellingham has got, rightfully, a lot of hype recently. I think even more so because he's at a club where he could still go up a level. So there's a lot of conversation around him, whereas I think a lot of the other players are kind of already at those top clubs, with the greatest of respect to Borussia Dortmund. So I'm going to say that the capacity for Jude Bellingham to have a higher ceiling, I'm going to go with him. But I think on that note of just how much he's played as well, I did a piece fairly recently on Jude Bellingham. And I think for under 20 players, players who are under 20 across Europe's top 5 leagues, he's comfortably played the most than any other, let's say, teenager since the start of last season. So certainly got a lot of experience in the bank already.
Started to get quite a few minutes at a very young age at Birmingham City. And I noticed off the bench in their last 3 or 4 league games, 17-year-old Jobe Bellingham has been getting some minutes, one to watch for sure.
Hello, James Richardson here, presenter of the Totally Football Show. It's a show about football, and sometimes it's about life, and usually it's about an hour long. This Thursday, it's particularly about the midweek Premier League games, Ten Hag against Conte, South Coast Derby dust-up between Bournemouth and Saints, and the story tradition of the All-West London Brentford-Chelsea clash. I'll be asking dumb questions, Duncan Alexander, Carl Anker and Ahmed Schubel will have clever answers, and you can find all of that by searching for the Totally Football Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Michael, the Women's Ballon d'Or award was won by Alexia Putellas. She's gone back-to-back. That's 2 years in a row that she's won this. Of course, as we discussed during the Women's Euros and our coverage of it, Putellas was absent. An ACL injury before the tournament didn't make her mark on that, the sort of big international tournament of the year. Was her club season that good that being at the Euros didn't matter? Was she the worthy winner here?
It was very good. I mean, week in, week out, she does just score goals, get assists. Whenever you watch her play, she just dominates the game like probably no other player in women's football. So I think you can justify her being up there. I personally wouldn't have gone for her. I would have paid a bit more attention to the Euros. And I think her club teammate, Aitana Bonmatí, is similarly influential for a club, not quite as influential, but did have a really good Euros as well. I mean, she only got to the quarterfinals, but I think off the top of my head, at least three of those four games, she was the best player on the pitch. I think she's absolutely fantastic. So I would have gone for Bonmatí ahead of Putellas. So you do wonder sometimes whether there's, you know, if there's two players from the same club, whether one of them is a bit hard done by. And I think that probably has happened here.
That's interesting as well. I mean, it does go against the grain somewhat for all that we spoke about with the men's awards, that Putellas didn't win any, which is winning the individual awards, but didn't win any club or country awards, because Barça Femení obviously didn't win the Champions League either. 3-1 loss to Lyon. I think she scored within that final, still affecting the game, but for her club, and obviously didn't make it with a country to the Euros. It does kind of go against the grain for what we spoke about with the men's, that someone who's winning it individually hasn't actually got the club or country accolade.
Elsewhere in the top five, Beth Mead was second, Michael Sam Kerr third, Lena Oberdorf at fourth, and Bonmatí, as you mentioned, fifth. We did a whole episode around this time last year, sort of panning the FIFA Pro World 11 for the women's game as just seemingly being cobbled together on reputations more so than performances. Do you think this Ballon d'Or podium is a better effort, improvements on that front?
It probably is. I think it was quite a tough one to vote on this year, because there's quite a lot of players who either did it in the Champions League or did it in the Euros, but not both. So Ada Hegerberg won the Champions League, but Norway had a disastrous European Championship, and she was obviously part of that. Alex Popp, for me, was quite clearly the best player at the Euros, but because of injuries, didn't play much for her club. Sam Kerr, obviously Australian, didn't take part in the Euros. Oberdorf is a player who I think really, her Euros performance was what puts her up here. Putellas missed the Euros. So it was quite a difficult one to vote on, I would say. Mm. And that's kind of the reason I would go for Bonmatí, because I think she performed in both. I note down in 10th position, there's Lucy Bronze, who I think it's a bit charitable for her to be in the top 10. And she's now at Barcelona, but she was last season at Manchester City. So is that the reason why City have won Club of the Year, genuinely? Because they've got...
Maybe.
Because Real Madrid haven't got anyone on the list. So I think that's the sixth player for Man City.
I need to go back and look at this.
Yeah, maybe that has tipped them into Club of the Year. A player who doesn't even play for them anymore because they couldn't be bothered to renew a contract has won them Club of the Year. So well done, Lucy Bronze.
Could Bronze have made all the difference? I think quite strongly that with a name like Bronze, you either come third or you don't come anywhere, personally, but that's just me. Brilliant. Well, thank you, guys. It's been really interesting to chat through awards, Ballon d'Or winners and runners-up and contenders in the men and women's game, and the Copper Award as well. So thank you for your time and expertise this week. We go again next week on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. I'm going to put in some calls, see if we can get Thibaut Courtois on as a special guest. Some fireworks firing off, because if Michael finds him quite annoying, we should hear what Courtois thinks about Michael Cox's work. I think that could be a bit of fun. Both of you very busy on site at the moment. Lots of written content going up. You're both in rhythm. I think I can say that. I'm sure you'd be too humble to do so. So do head to The Athletic to read all of their articles. And if you're not a subscriber, but you'd like to become one today, theathletic.com/tactics is the place to be. And make sure you join us next week. Make sure you're subscribed to The Athletic Football Tactics podcast. Goodbye.
The Athletic.